but you're wrong. We'll determine how you did it, and we'll follow it back to you. And when we do, I'll be there to make sure you never hurt anyone again. Knock yourself out, I told him. It was hard, really hard, to keep my voice as blithe as I wanted it to sound. I didn't do it, but I'm helping the police to find the man who did. The police? Morgan asked. He narrowed his eyes as though gauging my expression. As if they could have any authority on this matter. It won't do you any good. Even if you do set someone up to take the fall for you under mortal law, the White Council will see that justice is done. His eyes glittered, fanatic bright, underneath the stars. Whatever. Look, if you find out something about the killer, anything that could help the cops out, would you give me a call? Morgan looked at me with profound distaste. You ask me to warn you when we are closing in on you, Dresden? You are young, but I never thought you stupid. I bit back the obvious comment that leapt to mind. Morgan was on the edge of outrage already. If I'd realized how rabid he was to catch me slipping, I wouldn't have added more fuel to his fire by hitting him in the mouth. Okay, I probably would have still hit him in the mouth, but I wouldn't have done it quite so hard. Good night, Morgan, I told him. I started to walk away again before I could let my mouth get me into more trouble. He moved faster than I would have given a man his age credit for. His fist went across my jaw at approximately 1,000,000 miles an hour, and I spun down to the dirt like a string-cut puppet. For several long moments, I was unable to do anything at all, even breathe. Morgan loomed over me. We'll be watching you, Dresden. He turned and started walking away, the shadows of the evening quickly swallowing up his black coat. His voice drifted back to me. We'll find out what really happened. I didn't dare spout out a snappy comeback. I felt my jaw with my fingers and made sure it wasn't broken before I stood up and walked back to the Beetle, my legs feeling loose and watery. I fervently hoped that Morgan would find out what really happened. It would keep the White Council from executing me for breaking the first law, for one thing. I could feel his eyes on my back all the way to the Beetle. Damn that Morgan. He didn't have to take quite so much pleasure in being assigned to spy on me. I had a sinking feeling that anywhere I went over the next few days, he would be likely to turn up, watching. He was like a big cartoon tomcat waiting outside the mouse hole for a little mouse to stick its nose out so he could smash it flat with one big paw. I was feeling a lot like that little mouse. I let that analogy cheer me up a little bit. The cartoon cats always seem to get the short end of the stick in the final analysis. Maybe Morgan would, too. Part of the problem was that seeing Morgan always brought up too many memories of my angsty teenage days. That's when I started to learn magic, when my mentor had tried to seduce me into black wizardry, and when he had attempted to kill me when he failed. I killed him instead, mostly by luck, but he was just as dead, and I'd done it with sorcery. I broke the first law of magic, thou shalt not kill. There's only one sentence, if someone is found guilty, and one sword that they use to carry it out. The White Council commuted the death sentence because tradition demands that a wizard can resort to the use of deadly force if he is defending his own life or the lives of the defenseless, and my claim that I had been attacked first could not be contested by my master's corpse. So instead, they stuck me on a kind of accelerated probation. One strike and I was out. There were some wizards who thought that the judgment against me was a ludicrous injustice. I happened to be one of them, but my vote didn't really count. And others who thought that I should have been executed regardless of extenuating circumstances. Morgan belonged to the latter group. Just my luck. I was feeling more than a bit surly at the entire White Council, benevolent intentions aside. I guess it only made sense that they suspected me, and God knows I'd been a thorn in their side, flying in the face of tradition by practicing my art openly. There were plenty of people in the White Council who might well want me dead. I would have to start being more careful. I rolled down the Beetle's windows on the way back to the Chicago to help me stay awake. I was exhausted, but my mind was racing around like a hamster in an exercise wheel, working furiously, getting nowhere. The irony was thick enough to make my tongue curl. The White Council suspected me of the killings, and if no other suspect came forward, I was going to take the rap. Murphy's investigation had just become very, very important to me. But to pursue the investigation, I would have to figure out how the killer had pulled off that spell. And to do that, I would have to indulge in highly questionable research that would probably be enough to get me the death sentence all by itself. Catch 22. If I had any respect at all for Morgan's intelligence, I would have suspected him of pulling off the killings himself and setting me up to take the blame. But that just didn't track. Morgan might twist and bend the rule to get what he saw as justice, but he never blatantly violated them. But if not Morgan, then who would have done it? There just weren't all that many people who could get enough power into that kind of spell to make it work. Unless there was some flaw in the quasi-physics that governed magic that let hearts explode more easily than other things. And I wouldn't know that until I'd pursued the forbidden research. Bianca would have more information on who might have done it. She had to. I had already planned on talking to the vampirist, but Morgan's visit had made it a necessity rather than a mere priority. Murphy was not going to be thrilled that I was thrusting myself into her side of the investigation. And better, because White Council business was all hush-hush to non-wizards, I wouldn't be able to explain to her why I was doing it. Further joy. You know, sometimes I think someone up there really hates me.
Please insert the next CD to continue the story.
By the time I got home, it was 2 o'clock in the morning. The clock in the Beetle didn't work, of course. But I made a pretty good guess from the position of the stars and the moon, and was strung out, weary, and my nerves were stretched as tight as guitar strings. I didn't think sleep was likely, so I decided to do a little alchemy to help me unwind. I'd often wished I'd had some suave and socially acceptable hobby that I could fall back on in times like this. You know, play the violin, or was it the viola, like Sherlock Holmes, or maybe twiddle away on the pipe organ like the Disney version of Captain Nemo. But I don't. I'm sort of the arcane equivalent of a classic computer geek. I do magic in one form or another, and that's pretty much it. I really need to get a life one of these days. I live in the basement apartment beneath a big, roomy old house that's been divided up into lots of different apartments. The basement and sub-basement below it are both mine, which is sort of neat. I'm the only tenant living on 2 floors, and my rent is cheaper than all the people who have whole windows. The house is full of creaks and sighs and settling boards, and time and lives have worn their impressions into the wood and the brick. I can hear all the sounds, all the character of the place, above and around me, all through the night. It's an odd place, but it sings in the darkness and is, in its own quirky little way, alive. It's home. Mister was waiting for me at the bottom of the stairs that led down to the apartment's front door. Mister is an enormous gray cat. I mean, enormous. There are dogs smaller than Mister. He weighs in at just over 30 pounds, and there isn't an undue amount of fat on his frame. I think maybe his father was a wildcat or a lynx or something. I had found Mister in a garbage can about 3.5 years before, a mewling kitten with his tail torn off by a dog or a car. I was never sure which. But Mister hated both and would either attack or flee from them on sight. Mister had recovered his dignity over the past few months and shortly came to believe that he was the apartment's tenant and that I was someone he barely tolerated to share the space with him. Right now, he looked up and meowled at me in an annoyed tone. "I thought you had a hot date," I told him. He sauntered over me and rammed one shoulder playfully against my knee. I wavered, recovered my balance, and unlocked the door. Mister, as was his due, entered before I did. My apartment is a studio, one not-too-large room with a kitchenette in one corner and a fireplace to one side. There's a door that leads to the other room, my bedroom and bathroom. And then there's the hinge door in the floor that goes down to the sub-basement, where I keep my lab. I've got things pretty heavily textured. There are multiple carpets on the floor, tapestries on the windows, and a collection of knick-knacks and oddities on every available surface. My staff and my sword cane in the corner, and several bulging bookshelves, which I really will organize one day. Mister went to his spot before the fireplace and demanded that it be made warm. I obliged him with a fire and lit a lamp as well. Oh, I have lights and so on, but they foul up so often it almost isn't worth turning them on. And I'm not even about to take chances with a gas heater. I stick to the simple things, the fireplace and my candles and lamps. I have a special charcoal stove and a vent to take most of the smoke out, though the whole place smells of wood smoke and charcoal a little, no matter what I do. I took off my duster and got out my heavy flannel robe before I went down into the lab. That's why wizards wear robes, I swear to you. It's just too damn cold down in the lab to go without one. I clambered down the ladder to the lab, carrying my candle with me, and lit a few lamps, a pair of burners, and a kerosene heater in the corner. Lights came up and revealed a long table in the center of the room, other tables against three of the walls around it, with a clear space at one end of the room where a brass circle had been laid out on the floor and fastened into the cement with the U-shaped bolts. Shelves of the tables were crowded with empty cages, boxes, Tupperware, jars, cans, containers of all descriptions, a pair of unusual antlers, a couple of fur pelts, several musty old books, a long row of notebooks filled with my own cramped writing, and a bleached white human skull. "Bob," I said. I started clearing space off the center table, dumping boxes and grocery sacks and plastic tubs over the brass circle on the floor. I needed time to work. "Bob, wake up." There was a moment of silence while I started getting some things down from the shelves. "Bob," I said louder. "Come on, lazy bones." A pair of lights came up in the empty sockets of the skull, orangish flickering like candle flames. "It isn't enough," the skull said, "that I have to wake up. I have to wake up to bad puns. What is it about you that you have to make bad puns?" "Stop whining," I told him cheerfully. "We've got work to do." Bob the Skull grumbled something in old French, I think, though I got lost when he got to the anatomical improbabilities of bullfrogs. He yawned. His bony teeth rattled when his mouth clicked closed again. Bob wasn't really a human skull. He was a spirit of air, sort of like a fairy, but different. He made his residence inside the skull that had been prepared for him several hundred years ago, and it was his job to remember things. For obvious reasons, I can't use a computer to store information and keep track of the slowly changing laws of quasi-physics. He had worked with dozens of wizards over the years, and it had given him a vast repertoire of knowledge. That, and a really cocky attitude. "Blasted wizards," he mumbled. "I can't sleep, so we're going to make a couple of potions. Sound good?"
"Like I have a choice," Bob said. "What's the occasion?"
I brought Bob up to speed on what had happened that day. He whistled, no easy trick without lips, and said, "Sounds sticky."
"Pretty sticky," I agreed. "Tell you what," he said. "Let me out for a ride, and I'll tell you how to get out of it." That made me wary.
"Bob, I let you out once, remember?"
He nodded dreamily, scraping a bone on wood shelf. "The sorority house, I remember."
I snorted and started some water to boiling over one of the burners. "You're supposed to be a spirit of intellect. I don't understand why you're obsessed with sex."
Bob's voice got defensive.
"It's an academic interest, Harry."
"Oh, yeah. Well, maybe I don't think it's fair to let your academia go peeping in on other people's houses."
"Wait a minute. My academia doesn't just peep." I held up a hand.
"Save it. I don't want to hear it."
He grunted. "You are trivializing what getting out for a bit means to me, Harry. You're insulting my masculinity."
"Bob," I said, "you're a skull. You don't have any masculinity to insult."
"Oh, yeah?" Bob challenged me.
"Pot, kettle, black, Harry. Have you gotten a date yet, Most men have something better to do in the middle of the night than play with their chemistry sets."
"As a matter of fact," I told him, "I am set for Saturday night."
Bob's eyes fluttered from orange to red.
"Ooh," he leered. "Is she pretty?"
"Dark skin," I said. "Dark hair, dark eyes, legs to die for, smart, sexy as hell."
Bob chortled.
"Think she'd like to see the lab?"
"Get your mind out of the gutter."
"No, seriously," Bob said. "If she's so great, what's she doing with you? You aren't exactly Segwayan, you know."
It was my turn to get defensive.
"She likes me," I said. "Is that such a shock?"
"Harry," Bob drawled, his eyelights flickering smugly. "What you know about women I could juggle."
I stared at Bob for a moment and realized with a somewhat sinking feeling that the skull was probably right. Not that I would admit that to him, not in a million years, but he was.
"We're going to make an escape potion," I told him. "I don't want to be all night, so can we get to work, huh? I can only remember about half the recipe."
"There's always room to make two if you're making one, Harry. You know that."
That much was true.
The process of mixing up an alchemy potion is largely stirring, simmering, and waiting. You can always get another one going and alternate between them. Sometimes you can even do three, but that's pushing it. Okay, so we'll make a copy.
Oh, come on, Bob chided me. That's dull. You should stretch yourself. Try something new.
Like what? I asked him. Bob's eye sockets twinkled cheerfully.
A love potion, Harry. If you won't let me out, at least let me do that.
Spirits know you could use it. No, I said firmly. No way. No love potion.
Fine, he said. No love potion.
No escape potion either. Bob, I said warningly.
Bob's eye lights winked out.
I growled. I was tired and cranky, and under the best of circumstances, I am not exactly a type A personality. I stalked over, picked up Bob by the jaws, and shook him.
Hey, I shouted. Bob, you come out of there, or I'm going to take this skull and throw it down the deepest well I can find, and I swear to you I'll put it somewhere where no one can ever let you out again.
Bob's eyes winked on for a moment.
No, you won't. I'm far too valuable.
Then they winked out again.
I gritted my teeth and tried not to smash the skull to little pieces on the floor.
I took deep breaths, summoning years of wizardry training and control not to throw a tantrum and break the nice spirit into little pieces. Instead, I put the skull back on the shelf and counted slowly to 30. Could I make the potion by myself? I probably could. But I had the sinking feeling that it might not have been precisely the effect I wanted. Potions were a tricky business, and a lot more relied upon precise details than upon intent, like in spells. And just because I made a love potion didn't mean I had to use it, right? It would only be good for a couple of days, in any case. Surely not through the weekend. How much trouble could it cause? I struggled to rationalize the action. It would appease Bob and give him some kind of vicarious thrill. Love potions were about the cheapest thing in the world to make, so it wouldn't cost me too much. And I thought, if Susan should ask me for some kind of demonstration of magic, as she always did, I could always... No, that would be too much. That would be like admitting I couldn't get a woman to like me on my own. And it would be unfair, taking advantage of the woman. What I wanted was the escape potion. I might need it at Bianca's place, and I could always use it, if worse came to worse, to make a getaway from Morgan and the White Council. I would feel a lot better if I had the escape potion. Okay, Bob, fine. You win. We'll do them both, all right? Bob's eyes came up warily. Are you sure? You'll do the love potion, just like I say?
Don't I always make the potions like you say, Bob?
What about the diet potion you tried?
Okay, that was a mistake. And the anti-gravity potion, remember that? We fixed the floor. That was no big deal. And the... Fine, I growled. You don't have to rub it in. Now cough up the recipes.
Bob did so, in fine humor. And for the next 2 hours, we made potions.
Potions are all made pretty much the same way. First, you need a base to form the essential liquid content, then something to engage each of the senses, and then something for the mind and something else for the spirit. 8 ingredients, all in all, and they're different for each and every potion, and for each person who's making them. Bob had centuries of experience, and he could extrapolate the most successful components for a given person to make into a potion. He was right about being an invaluable resource. I had never even heard of a spirit with Bob's experience, and I was lucky to have him. That didn't mean I didn't want to crack that skull of his from time to time, though. The escape potion was made in a base of 8 ounces of Jolt Cola. We added a drop of motor oil for the smell of it, cut a bird's feather into tiny shavings for the tactile value, 3 ounces of chocolate-covered espresso beans ground into powder went in next, then a shredded bus ticket I'd never used for the mind, and a small chain, which I broke and then dropped in, for the heart. I unfolded a clean white cloth where I had a flickering shadow stored for just such an occasion and tossed it into the brew, then opened up a glass jar where I kept my mouse campers and tapped the sound into the beaker where the solution was brewing.
You sure this is going to work, Bob? I said.
Always. That's a super recipe there.
Smells terrible.
Bob's lights twinkled.
They usually do.
What's it doing? Is this the super speed one or the teleportation version?
Bob coughed.
A little of both, actually. Drink it and you'll be the wind for a few minutes.
The wind?
I eyed him. I haven't heard of that one before, Bob. I'm an air spirit, after all, Bob told me. This'll work fine. Trust me.
I grumbled and set the first potion to simmering, then started on the next one. I hesitated after Bob told me the first ingredient.
Tequila? I asked him skeptically. Are you sure on that one? I thought the base for a love potion was supposed to be champagne.
Champagne, tequila, what's the difference? So long as it'll lower her inhibitions, Bob said.
I'm thinking it's going to get us a sleazier result.
Hey, Bob protested. Who's the memory spirit here, me or you?
Well,
who's got all the experience with women here, me or you?
Bob.
Harry.
Bob lectured me. I was seducing shepherdesses when you weren't a twinkle in your great-grandcestor's eyes. I think I know what I'm doing. I sighed, too tired to argue. Okay, okay, sheesh. Tequila.
I got down the bottle, measured 8 ounces into the beaker, and glanced up at the skull. Right. Now, 3 ounces of dark chocolate.
Chocolate? I demanded.
Chicks are into chocolate, Harry.
I muttered, more interested in finishing than anything else, and measured out the ingredients. I did the same with a drop of perfume, some name-brand imitation that I liked. 1 ounce of shredded lace, and the last sigh at the bottom of the glass jar. I added some candlelight to the mix, and it took on a rosy golden glow.
Great, said Bob. That's just right. Okay, now we'll add the ashes of a passionate love letter. I blinked at the skull.
Bob, I'm fresh out of those.
Bob snorted. Oh, how did I guess? Look on the shelf behind me.
I did, and found a pair of romance novels, their covers filled with impossibly delightful flesh.
Hey, where did you get these?
My last trip out, Bob answered blithefully. Page 174, the paragraph that starts with, her milky white breasts. Tear that page out and burn it and add those ashes in. I choked.
Will that work?
Hey, women eat these things up, trust me. Fine, I sighed. Is there a spirit ingredient?
Mm-hmm,
Bob said. He was rocking back and forth on his jawbones in excitement. Now just a teaspoon of powdered diamond and we're done.
I rubbed my eyes. Diamond? I don't have any diamonds, Bob.
I figured. You're cheap. That's why women don't like you.
Look, just tear up a 50 into real little pieces and put that in there.
A $50 bill? I demanded.
Money, Bob opined. Very sexy.
I muttered and got my remaining 50 out of my pocket, shredding it and tossing it in to complete the potion. The next step is where the effort came in. Once all the ingredients are mixed, you have to force enough energy through them to activate them. It isn't the actual physical ingredients that are important. It's the meaning that they carry, too. The significance that they have for the person making the potion and for those who will be using it. The energy from magic comes from a lot of places. It can come from a special place, usually some spectacular natural site like Mount St. Helens or Old Faithful. A focus of some kind, like Stonehenge, is on a large scale, or from inside of people. The best magic comes from inside. Sometimes it's just pure mental effort, raw willpower. Sometimes it's emotions and feelings. All of them are viable tender to be used for the proverbial fire. I had a lot of worry to use to fuel the magic. A lot of annoyance, and one hell of a lot of stubbornness. I murmured the requisite quasi-Latin litany over the potions over and over, feeling a kind of resistance building, just out of range of my physical senses, but there, nonetheless. I gathered up all my worry and anger and stubbornness and threw them all at the resistance in one big ball, shaping them with the strength and tone of my words. The magic left me in a sudden wave, like a pitcher abruptly emptied out.
I love this pot, Bob said, just as the potions exploded into puffs of greenish smoke and began to froth up over the lips of the beakers.
I sagged onto the stool and waited for the potions to fizz down, all the strength gone out of me, the weariness building up like a load of bricks on my shoulders. Once the frothing had settled, I leaned over and poured each potion into its individual sports bottle with a squeeze top, then labeled the containers with a permanent magic marker, very clearly. I don't take chances in getting potions mixed up anymore, ever since the invisibility hair tonic incident when I was trying to grow out a decent beard.
You won't regret this, Harry, Bob assured me. That's the best potion I've ever made.
I made it, not you, I growled. I was really exhausted now. Way too tired to let petty concerns like possible executions keep me from bed.
Sure, sure, Bob agreed. Whatever, Harry. I went around the room, putting out all the fires and the kerosene heater, and then climbed the ladder back to the basement without saying goodnight. Bob was chortling happily to himself as I did. I stumbled to my bed and fell into it. Mister always climbs in and goes to sleep draped over my legs. I waited for him, and a few seconds later he showed up, settling down and purring like a miniature outboard motor. I struggled to put together an itinerary for the next couple of days through the haze of exhaustion. Talk to the vampire, locate missing husband, avoid the wrath of the White Council, find the killer before he found me. An unpleasant thought. But I decided I wasn't going to let that bother me either, and curled up to go to sleep. Friday night, I went to see Bianca, the vampress. I didn't just leap out of bed and go see her, of course. You don't go walking into the proverbial lion's den lightly. You start with a good breakfast. My breakfast took place around 3 PM when I woke up to hear my phone ringing. I had to get out of bed and pad into the main room to answer it. I grumbled. Dresden, Murphy said. What can you tell me? Murphy sounded stressed. Her voice had that distinct edge that she got whenever she was nervous, and it rankled me, like fingernails scraping on bones. The investigation into Tommy Tom's murder must not be going well. Nothing yet, I said. Then I lied to her a little. I was up most of the night working, but nothing showed yet. She answered me with a swear word. That's not good enough, Harry. I need answers, and I need them yesterday. I'll get to it as quick as I can. Get to it faster, she snarled. She was angry. Not that this was unusual for Murphy, but it told me that something else was going on. Some people panic when things get rough, harried. Some people fall apart. Murphy got pissed. Commissioner's riding your back again? City Police Commissioner Howard Fairweather used Murphy and her team as scapegoats for all sorts of unsolvable crimes that he had dumped into her lap. Fairweather was always lurking around, trying for an opportunity to make Murphy look bad, as though by doing so he would avoid being crucified himself. Like a winged monkey from the Wizard of Oz. Kind of makes you wonder who's leaning on him to get things done. Her voice was sour as ripe lemons. I heard her drop an Alka-Seltzer into a glass of liquid. I'm serious, Harry. You get me those answers I need, and you get them fast. I need to know if this was sorcery, and if so, how it was done, and who could have done it. Names, places, I need to know everything. It isn't that simple, then make it simple. How long before you can tell me? I need an estimate for the Commissioner's Investigative Committee in 15 minutes, or I might as well turn in my badge today. I grimaced. If I was able to get something out of Bianca, I might be able to help Murph on the investigation. But if it proved fruitless, I was going to have to spend the entire evening doing nothing productive. And Murphy needed her answers now. Maybe I should have made a stay-awake potion. Does the committee work weekends? Murphy snorted.
Are you kidding?
We'll have something by Monday, then.
You can have it figured out by then?
She asked. I don't know how much good it'll do you, even if I can puzzle it out. I hope you've got more to go on than this. I heard her sigh into the phone and drank the fizzy drink. Don't let me down, Harry. Time to change the subject before she pinned me down and smelled me lying. I had no intention of doing the forbidden research if I could find a way out of doing it. No luck with Bianca? Another swear word.
That bitch won't talk to us. Just smiles and nods and blows smoke, makes small talk, and crosses her legs.
You should have seen Carmichael drooling. Well, tough to blame him, maybe. I hear she's cute. Listen, Murph, what if I just...
No, Harry, absolutely not. You will not go over to the Velvet Room. You will not talk to that woman. You will not get involved in this.
Lieutenant Murphy, I drawled, a little jealous, are we?
Don't flatter yourself. You're a civilian, Dresden. Even if you do have your investigator's license, if you get your ass laid out in the hospital or the morgue, it'll be me that suffers for it.
Murph, I'm touched. I'll touch your head to a brick wall a few times if you cross me on this, Harry. Her voice was sharp, vehement.
Hey, wind down, Murph. If you don't want me to go, no problem.
Whoops, a lie. She'd be all over that like a troll on a billy goat.
You're a lousy liar, Harry. God damn it, I gotta take you down to lock up just to keep you from...
What? I said loudly into the receiver. Murph, you're breaking up. I can't hear you. Damn phone again.
Call me back. Then I hung up on her. Mister padded over to me and batted at my leg. He watched me with serious green eyes as I leaned down and unplugged the phone as it started to ring again. Okay, mister. You hungry? I got us breakfast. Leftover steak sandwich for him. SpaghettiOs heated up on my wood stove for me. I rationed out my last can of Coke, which Mr. craves at least as badly as I do, and by the time I was done eating and drinking and petting, I was awake and thinking again, and getting ready for sundown. Daylight savings time hadn't cut it yet. The dark would fall around 6. I had about 2 hours to get set to go. You might think you know a thing or two about vampires. Maybe some of the stuff you've heard is accurate. Likely it's not. Either way, I wasn't looking forward to the prospect of going into Bianca's lair to demand information from her. I was going to assume that things were going to get ugly before all was said and done, just to make sure I didn't get caught with my staff down. Wizardry is all about thinking ahead, about being prepared. Wizards aren't really superhuman. We just have a leg up on seeing things more clearly than other people, and being able to use the extra information we have for our benefit. Hell, the word wizard comes from the same root as wise. We know things. We aren't any stronger or faster than anyone else. We don't even have all that much more going on in the mental department. But we're god-awful sneaky, and if we get the chance to get set for something, we can do some impressive things. As a wizard, if you're ready to address a problem, then it's likely that you'll be able to come up with something that will let you deal with it. So I got together all the things I thought I might need. I made sure my cane was polished and ready. I put my silver knife in a sheath that hung just under my left arm. I put the escape potion in its plastic squeeze bottle into my duster's pocket. I put on my favorite talisman, a silver pentacle on a silver chain. It had been my mother's. My father had passed it down to me. And I put a small, folded piece of white cloth into my pocket. I had several enchanted items around, or half-enchanted items, anyway. Carrying out a full enchantment is expensive and time-consuming, and I just couldn't afford to do it very much. We blue-collar wizards just have to sling out a few spells where we can and hope they don't go stale at the wrong time. I would have been a lot more comfortable if I'd been carrying my blasting rod or my staff, but that would look like showing up at Bianca's door in a tank, walking in carrying a machine gun and a flamethrower while announcing my intention to fight. I had to maintain a fine balance between going in ready for trouble and going in asking for trouble. Not that I was afraid, mind you. I didn't think Bianca would be willing to cause problems for a mortal wizard. Bianca wouldn't want to piss off the White Council by messing with me. On the other hand, I wasn't exactly the White Council's favorite guy. They might even look the other way if Bianca decided to take me quietly out of the picture. Careful, Harry, I warned myself. Don't get paranoid. If you get like that, you'll be building your little apartment into the basement of solitude. What do you think? I asked Mister, once I was decked out in what paraphernalia I was willing to carry. Mister went to the door and batted at it insistently. Everyone's a critic. Fine, fine, I sighed. I let him out, then I went out, got into my car, and drove down to the Velvet Room in its expensive lakeside location. Bianca runs her business out of an old huge mansion from the early days of the Roaring Twenties. Rumor has it that the infamous Al Capone had built it for one of his mistresses. There was a gate with an iron fence and a security guard. I pulled the Beetle up to the little swath of driveway that began at the street and ended at the fence. There was a hiccuping rattle from the back of the engine as I brought the machine to a halt. I rolled down the window and stuck my head out, peering back. Something went whoom, and then black smoke poured out from the bottom of the car and scuttled down the slope of the drive and into the street. I winced. The engine gave an almost apologetic rattle and shuddered to its death. Great. Now I had no ride home. I got out of the Beetle and stood mourning it for a moment. The security guard on the other side of the gate was a blocky man. Not overly tall, but overly muscled, and hiding it under an expensive suit. He studied me with attack dog eyes, and then said through the gate, "Do you have an appointment?" "No," I told him, "but I think Bianca will want to see me." He looked at me unimpressed. "I'm sorry," he said. "Bianca's out for the evening." Things are never simple anymore.
I shrugged at him, folded my arms, and leaned on the hood of the Beetle.
Suit yourself. I'll just stay until a tow truck comes by then, until I can get this thing out of the drive for you.
He stared at me, his eyes narrowed down to tiny slits with the effort of thinking. Eventually, the thoughts got to his brain, got processed, and sent back out with a message to pass the buck.
I'll call your name in, he said.
Good man, I approved. You won't be sorry.
Name, he growled.
Harry Dresden. If he recognized my name and didn't show on his face, he glared at me and the Beetle and walked off a few paces, lifting a cellular phone from his pocket and to his ear. I listened. Listening isn't hard to do. No one has practice at it nowadays, but you can train yourself to pay attention to your senses, if you work at it long enough.
I got a guy down here that says that Bianca will want to talk to him, the guard said. Says his name is Harry Dresden.
He was silent for a moment. I couldn't quite make out the buzz of the other voice, other than it was a female.
Mm-hmm,
he said. He glanced back at me.
Mm-hmm,
he said again.
Sure, sure I will. Oh, of course, ma'am.
I reached in through the window of the Beetle and got out my cane. I rested it on the concrete beside my boots and tapped it a few times, as though impatient. The guard turned back to me, leaned over to one side, and pushed a button somewhere. The gate buzzed and clicked open.
Come on in, Mr. Dresden, he said. I can have someone come and tow your car if you like.
Super, I told him. I gave him the name of the wrecker Mike has to deal with, and told him to tell the guy that it was Harry's car again. Fido, the guard, dutifully noted this down, writing on a small notebook he drew from a pocket. While he did, I walked past him toward the house, clicking my cane on the concrete with every pace.
Stop, he told me, his voice calm and confident.
People don't speak with that kind of absolute authority unless they have a gun in their hands. I stopped.
Put the cane down, he told me, and put your arms up. You are to be searched before you are allowed inside.
I sighed. I did what he said, and let him pat me down. I didn't turn around to face him, but I could smell the metal of his gun. He found the knife and took it. His fingers brushed the nape of my neck, felt the chain there.
What's this? He said.
Pentacle, I told him. Let me see it. Use one hand. I used my left hand to draw it out of my shirt and show it to him. A silver five-pointed star within a circle, all smooth geometry. He grunted and said,
fine.
The search went on, and he found the plastic squeeze bottle. He took it out of my pocket, opened it, and sniffed at it.
What's this?
A health cola, I said.
Smells like shit, he said.
Capped it and put it back in my pocket. What about my cane?
Returned when you leave, he said.
Damn. My knife and my cane had been my only physical lines of defense. Anything else I did would have to rely wholly upon magic, and that would be dicey on the best of days. It was enough to rattle me. Of course, Fido the guard had missed a couple of things. First, he'd overlooked the clean white handkerchief in my pocket. Second, he'd passed me on with my pentacle still upon my neck. He probably figured that since it wasn't a crucifix or even a cross, that I couldn't use it to keep Bianca away from me. Which wasn't true. Vampires, and other such creatures, don't respond to symbols as such. They respond to the power that accompanies an act of faith. I couldn't ward off a vampire mosquito with my faith in the Almighty. He and I just never seemed to connect. But the pentacle was a symbol of magic itself, and I had plenty of faith in that. And, of course, Fido had overlooked my getaway potion. Bianca really ought to trust her guards with more awareness of the supernatural and what sort of things to look for. The house itself was elegant, very roomy, with the high ceilings and the broad floors that they just don't make anymore. A well-groomed young woman with a short, straight haircut greeted me in an enormous entry hall. I was passing polite to her, and she showed me to the library, its walls lined with old books in leather bindings, similar to the leather cushioned chairs around the enormous old dogfoot table in the room center. I took a seat and waited, and waited, and waited. More than a half an hour went by before Bianca finally arrived. She came into the room like a candle burning with a cold, clear flame. Her hair was a burnished shade of auburn that was too dark to cast any ruddy highlights, but it did anyway. Her eyes were dark, clear, her complexion flawlessly smooth and elegantly graced with cosmetics. She was not a tall woman, but was shapely, wearing a black dress with a plunging neckline and a slash to one side that showed off a generous portion of pale thigh. Black gloves covered her hands to above the elbows, and her $300 shoes were a study in high-heeled torture devices. She looked too good to be true. "Mr. Dresden," she greeted me, "this is an unexpected pleasure." I rose when she entered the room. "Madame Bianca," I replied, nodding to her, "we meet at last. Hearsay neglected to mention how lovely you are." She laughed, lips shaped the sounds, head falling back just enough to show a flash of pale throat. "A gentleman," they said. I see they were correct. It is a charmingly passé thing to be a gentleman in this country. "You and I are of another world," I said. She approached me and extended her hand, a motion oozing feminine grace. I bowed over her hand briefly, taking it and brushing my lips against the back of her glove. "Do you really think I'm beautiful, Mr. Dresden?" she asked me. "As lovely as a star, madam." "Polite and a pretty one, too," she murmured. Her eyes flickered over me from head to toe, but even she avoided meeting gazes with me. Whether from a desire to avoid inadvertently directing her power at me or being on the receiving end of mine, I couldn't tell. She continued into the room and stopped beside one of the comfortable chairs. As a matter of course, I stepped around the table and drew out the chair for her, seating her. She crossed her legs in that dress, in those shoes, and made it look good. I blinked for just a moment, then returned to my seat. "So, Mr. Dresden, what brings you to my humble house? Care for an evening of entertainment? I quite assure you that you will never have another experience like it." She placed her hands in her lap, smiling at me. I smiled at her, and put one hand into my pocket, onto the white handkerchief. "No, thank you. I came to talk." Her lips parted a silent, "Ah, I see. About what, if I might ask?" "About Jennifer Stanton and her murder." I had all of a second's warning. Bianca's eyes narrowed, then widened like those of a cat about to spring. Then she was coming at me over the table, faster than a breath, her arms extended toward my throat. I toppled over backwards in my chair. Even though I'd started to move first, it wasn't enough to get away from her reaching nails in time. One grazed my throat with a hot sensation of pain, and she kept coming, following me down to the floor, those rich lips drawn back from sharp fangs. I jerked my hand out of my pocket and flapped open my white hanky at her, releasing the image of sunlight I'd been storing for use in potions. It lit up the room for a moment, brilliant. The light smashed into Bianca, hurled her back across the old table into one of the shelves, and tore pieces of flesh from her like bits of rotten meat being peeled off a carcass by a sandblaster. She screamed, and the flesh around her mouth sloughed and peeled away like a snake's scales. I had never seen a real vampire before. I would have time to be terrified later. I took in the details as I tugged my talisman off over my neck. It had a bat-like face, horrid and ugly. The head too big for its body, gaping, hungry jaws. Its shoulders were hunched and powerful. Membrous wings stretched out between the joints of its almost skeletal arms. Flabby black breasts hung before it, spilling out of the black dress that no longer looked feminine. Its eyes were wide and black and staring, and a kind of leathery, slimy hide covered its flesh, like an inner tube lathered with Vaseline, though there were tiny holes corroded in it by the sunlight I had brought with me. It recovered quickly, crouching and spreading long arms that ended in clawed, tipped fingers to either side with a hiss of rage. I drew my pentacle into my fist, raised it like every vampire slayer you ever saw does, and said, "Jesus Christ, lady, just came here to talk." The vampire hissed and startled towards me with a gangling, weirdly graceful step. Its clawed feet were still wearing the $300 black pumps. "Back," I said, taking a step towards it myself. The pentacle began to burn with the cold, clear light of applied will and belief. My faith, if you will, that it could turn such a monster aside. It hissed and turned its face aside, lifting its membranous arms to shield its eyes from the light. It took one step back and then another until its hunched back was pressed against a wall of books. Now what do I do? I wasn't going to try to put a stake through her heart. But if I lowered my will, she might come at me again. And I didn't think I had anything, even the quickest evocations, that I could get out of my mouth before she tore it off my head. And even if I got past her, she probably had mortal lackeys, like the security guard at the gate, who would be happy to kill me if they saw me trashing their mistress.
"You killed her," the vampire snarled, and its voice was exactly the same, sultry and feminine. Even though twisted by rage and coming from that horrid mouth, it was unsettling. "You killed Jennifer. She was mine, Mageling."
"Look," I told her, "I didn't come here for any of this, and the police know I'm here. Save yourself a lot of trouble. Sit down, talk with me, and we'll both go away happy." "Christ, Bianca, do you think that if I'd killed Jennifer and Tommy Tom, that I'd just be waltzing in here like this?"
"You expect me to believe that you didn't? You will never leave this house alive."
I was feeling angry myself, and frightened. Christ, even the vampire thought I was a bad guy. "What'll it take to convince you that I didn't do it?" Black, bottomless eyes stared at me through the burning fire of my faith. I could feel some sort of power there, trying to get at me, and held off by the force of my will, just as the creature itself was. The vampire snarled.
"Lower the amulet, wizard."
"If I do, are you going to come at my throat again?"
"If you do not, I most certainly will."
Shaky logic, that. I tried to work through this situation from her point of view. She had been scared when I showed up. She had me searched and divested of weapons as best she could. If she thought I was Jennifer Stanton's murderer, would the mere mention of that name have brought that sudden violence out of her? I began to get that sinking feeling you get when you realize that not everything is as it appears. "If I put this down," I told her, "I want your word that you'll sit down and talk with me. I swear to you, by fire and wind, that I had nothing to do with her death." The vampire hissed at me, shielding its eyes from the light with one taloned hand.
"Why should I believe you?"
"Why should I believe you?" I countered. Yellowed fangs showed in its mouth.
"If you do not trust my word, wizard, then how can I trust yours?"
"Then you give it?" The vampire stiffened, and though its voice was still harsh with rage and pain, still sexy as a silk shirt without any buttons, I thought I heard a ring of truth in its words.
"You have my promise. Lower the talisman. We will talk."
Time for another calculated risk. I tossed the pinnacle onto the table. The cold light drained away, leaving the room lit by mere electricity again. The vampire slowly lowered its arms, blinking its two big eyes at me, and then at the pentacle upon the table. A long pink tongue flickered out nervously over its jaws and lowered face, then slipped back into its mouth. It was surprised, I realized. Surprised that I'd done it. My heart was racing, but I forced my fear back down out of my forebrain and into the background. Vampires are like demons, like wolves, like sharks. You don't let them think that you are potential food and get their respect at the same time. The vampire's true appearance was grotesque, but it wasn't as bad as some of the things I'd seen in my day. Some demons were a lot worse, and some of the elder things could rip your mind apart just by letting you look at them. I regarded the creature with a level gaze. "How about it?" I said. "Let's talk. The longer we sit around staring at one another, the longer Jennifer's killer stays free." The vampire stared at me for a moment more. Then it shuddered, drawing its wings and membranes about itself. Black slime turned into patches of pale, perfect flesh that spread over the vampire's dark skin like a growth of fungus. The flabby black breasts swelled into softly rounded, rosy-tipped perfection once more. Bianca stood before me a moment later, settling her dress back into modesty again. Her arms crossed over her as though she was cold, her back stiff and her eyes angry. She was no less beautiful than she had been a few moments before, not a line or curve any different. But for me, the glamour had been ruined. She still had the same eyes, dark and fathomless and alien. I would always remember what she truly looked like beneath her flesh mask. I stooped and picked up my chair, righting it. Then I went around the table, turned my back on her, and stood hers up as well. Then I held it out for her, just as I had when I entered the room. She stared at me for a long moment. Some expression flickered across her face. She was disconcerted by my apparent lack of concern about the way she looked, and it told. Then she lifted her chin, proud, and settled gracefully into the chair again, regal as any queen, every line stiff with anger. The old rules of courtesy and hospitality were holding, but for how long? I returned to my seat and leaned over to pick up my white handkerchief, toying with it. Bianca's angry eyes flickered down to it, and once again she repeated the nervous gesture of licking her teeth and lips, though this time her tongue looked human. "So, tell me about Jennifer and Tommy Tom," I said. She shook her head, almost sneering. "I can tell you what I told the police. I don't know who could have killed them." "Come on, Bianca. We don't have to hide things from one another. We're not part of the mortal world." Her eyebrows slanted down, revealing more anger. "No. You're the only one in the city with the kind of skill required to cast that sort of spell. If you didn't, I have no idea who else could have."
"You don't have any enemies? Anyone who might have been wanting to make an impression on you?"
A bitter little line appeared at the corner of her lips, something that was not quite a smile. "Of course. But none of them could have managed what happened to Tommy and Jenny." She drummed her fingernails over the tabletop, leaving little score marks in the wood. "I don't let any enemies that dangerous run around alive. At least not for long."
I settled back in my chair, frowning, and did my damnedest not to let her see how scared I was.
"How did you know Tommy Tom?"
She shrugged, her shoulders gleaming like porcelain, and just as brittle.
"You may have thought he was just a bruiser for Johnny Marcone, Mr. Dresden, but Tommy was a very gentle and considerate man underneath. He was always good to his women. He treated them like real people."
Her gaze shifted from side to side, not lifting.
"Like human beings. I wouldn't take on a client if I thought he wouldn't be a gentleman, but Tommy was better than most. I met him years ago, elsewhere. I always made sure he had someone to take care of him when he wanted an evening of company."
"You sent Jennifer out to him that night?"
She nodded, her expression bleak. Her nails drummed the tabletop again, gouging out more wood.
"Was there anyone else who saw him on a regular basis? Maybe someone who would have talked to him, known what was going on in his life?"
Bianca shook her head. "No," she said, but then she frowned. "I just watched her," and absently tossed the handkerchief on the tabletop. Her eyes flicked to it, and then up to mine. I didn't flinch. I met her bottomless gaze and corked my mouth up in a little smile as though I had something more and worse to pull out of my hat if she wanted to come after me again. I saw her anger, her rage, and for just a moment I got a peek inside, saw the source of it. She was furious that I had seen her true form, horrified and embarrassed that I had stripped her disguise away and seen the creature underneath. And she was afraid that I could take away even her mask forever with my power. More than anything else, Bianca wanted to be beautiful. And tonight I had destroyed her illusion. I had rattled her gilded little world. She sure as hell wasn't going to let me forget that. She shuddered and jerked her eyes away, furious and frightened at the same time, before I could see any deeper into her, or she into me. "If I had not given you my word, Dresden," she whispered, "I would kill you this instant." "That would be unfortunate," I said. I kept my voice hard. "You know the risks in a wizard's death curse. You've got something to lose, Bianca. And even if you could take me out, you can bet your pretty ass I'd be dragging you into hell with me." She stiffened, then turned her head to one side and let her fingers go limp. It was a silent, bitter surrender. She didn't move quickly enough for me to miss seeing a tear streak down one cheek. I'd made a vampire cry. Great. I felt like a real superhero now. Harry Dresden, breaker of monsters' hearts. "There may be one person who might know something," she said, her lovely voice dull, flat, lifeless. "I had a woman who worked for me, Linda Randall. She and Jennifer went out on calls together. When customers wanted that sort of thing, they were close."
"Where is she now?" I asked.
"She's working as a driver for someone. Some rich couple who wanted a servant that would do more than windows. She wasn't the type I usually kept around in any case. I think Jennifer had her phone number. I can have someone fetch it for you Mr. Dresden. She said my name as though it were something bitter and poisonous that she wanted to spit out. Thank you. That would be very kind. I kept my tone carefully formal, neutral. Formality and a good bluff were all that was keeping her from my throat. She remained quiet, controlling her evident emotions, before she started to look up again at last. Her eyes froze, then widened when they came to my throat. Her expression went perfectly, inhumanly still. I grew tense. Not just tense. Steel-tight, wire-bound, spring-coiled. I was out of tricks and weapons. If she came after me now, I wasn't going to get the chance to defend myself. There was no way I would be able to drink the potion before she tore me apart. I gripped the arms of my chair hard to keep myself from bolting. Do not show fear. Do not run away. It would only make her chase me, snap her instincts into the reaction of pursuing the prey. "You're bleeding, Mr. Dresden," she whispered. I lifted my hand slowly to my throat, where her nails had scored on me earlier. My fingertips came away slick with my own blood. Bianca kept on staring. Her tongue flickered around her mouth again. "Cover it. Cover it," she whispered. A strange, mewling sound came out of her mouth. "Cover it, Dresden." I picked up my handkerchief and pressed it over my throat. Bianca blinked, her eyes closed slowly, and then turned away, half hunched over her stomach. She didn't stand up. "Go," she told me. "Go now. Paula's coming. I'll send her down to the gate with the phone number in a little while." I walked towards the door, but then stopped, glancing back at her. There was a sort of horrid fascination to it, to knowing what was beneath the alluring exterior, the flesh mask, but seeing it twist and writhe with need. "Go," Bianca whimpered. Fury, hunger, and some emotion I couldn't even begin to fathom made her voice stretch out thinner. "Go! And do not think I will not remember this night. Do not think I will not make you regret it." The door to the library opened, and the straight-haired young woman who had greeted me earlier entered the room. She gave me a passing glance, then walked past me, kneeling at Bianca's side. "Paula," I presumed. Paula murmured something too soft to hear, gently brushing Bianca's hair back from her face with one hand. Then she unbuttoned the sleeve of her blouse, rolling it up past her elbow, and pressed her wrist to Bianca's mouth. I had a good view of what happened. Bianca's tongue flashed out, long and pink and sticky, smearing Paula's wrist with shining saliva. Paula shuddered at the touch, her breath coming quicker. Her nipples stiffened beneath the thin fabric of the blouse, and she let her head fall slowly backwards. Her eyes were glazed over with a narcotic languor, like a junkie who had just shot up. Bianca's fangs extended and slashed open Paula's pale, pretty skin. Blood welled. Bianca's tongue began to flash in and out, faster than could really be seen, lapping the blood up as quickly as it appeared. Her dark eyes were narrow, distant. Paula was gasping and moaning in pleasure, her entire body shivering. I felt a little sick, and withdrew step by step, not turning my back on the scene. Paula toppled slowly to the floor, writhing her way toward unconsciousness with evident glee. Bianca followed her down, unladylike now, a creature of bestial hunger. She crouched over the supine woman, and in the hunch of her pale shoulders, I could see the bat-like thing beneath the flesh mask lapping up Paula's blood. I got out of there, fast, shutting the door behind me. My heart was hammering too quickly. The scene with Paula might have aroused me if I hadn't seen what was underneath Bianca's mask. Instead, it only made me sick to my stomach, afraid. That woman had given herself to that thing as quickly and as willingly as any woman to her lover. The saliva. Some part of me rationalized, desperate to latch onto something cold and logical and detached. The saliva was probably narcotic, probably even addictive. It would explain Paula's behavior, the need to have more of her drug. But I wondered if Paula would have been so eager had she known Bianca's true face. Now I understood why the White Council was so hard-nosed with vampires. If they could get that kind of control over a mortal, what would happen if they could get their hooks into a wizard? If they could addict a wizard to them as thoroughly as Bianca had the girl I'd just seen, surely it wasn't possible. But then, if it wasn't, Why would the Council be so nervous about them?
Do not think I will not make you regret it, she said.